Mrs. Mary R. from Tustin, California.
Good morning. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm so glad to be here, and I want to thank the Italian mafia over here. With the convention, the Democratic convention, and this thing going on up here, I meet nothing but I think the Italians are taking over the country, really. It's been a wonderful morning for me, especially because I had breakfast with a couple of the ladies that inspired me and helped me get sober and told me what sobriety was about. Fran, who I shared a lot of pain with and a lot of you know, and who is such a noble lady. And then there's Gerda, who I saw in the early, in my early sobriety, just survive valiantly with all the problems. And really, that's what AA to me is all about. They told me you don't drink before meetings, you don't drink after meetings, you don't drink between meetings, you don't drink if your ass falls off. What you do is learn a new way to sit down. Never mind these glory stories, you know, that you're going to get protracted happiness. It doesn't happen, believe me. Anyway, I'm up here to share my story, and I guess I can wrap up my whole drinking career by quoting what the cat said when he got through making love to the skunk. He said, "I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand." Sounds like you identify with that. I came from show business, and I left home when the day after I graduated from high school. I was somewhere around 16, and while I was on this road show, I was introduced to Slow Gin. And now I know that that dates me because that isn't the end drink. But regardless of whether it dates me, as a matter of fact, I've been thinking about getting a facelift like some of the ladies are doing these days, but then on sober consideration, what's the use of getting a facelift when everything else is sagging so 2 inches below where it used to? Yeah. God, I mean, it's a hell of a day when you find yourself trying on one of those cross your knees bras. Some of you ladies are identifying with that too. But, I was always told to tell it the way it was, be honest, get on with it. Anyway, I was an instant alcoholic. I don't know whether I was born an alcoholic, but I know when I took that first drink, an alcoholic was born. And, I never was able to handle it. I liked what it did for me right away. I liked the color of it and the taste and everything else. And I drank as much as I could, threw up and passed out, figured that's part of the deal. And that's the way it was. I can't say that I was a daily drunk in the beginning. I was never able to accurately predict my conduct, I can tell you. But I never was. Every time I started drinking, though, it never occurred to me to, tone it down or try to handle it. It just never occurred to me. I always overshot the field. I always got drunker than I thought I was going to or that I intended to. But anyway, after this tour, I wound up in the nightclubs of San Francisco. So, I got a lot of basic training around this area. And, San Francisco is a drinking town, and I fit right in there. I drank all over the place, and I loved it. I loved it. I used to get sick as hell, but that didn't bother me at all. I was working in some of the nicest nightclubs in San Francisco. And as a matter of fact, Herb Cain used to call me the Belle of Bush Street when I was working at the Royal Hawaiian up there, if any of you remember that. And see, there's somebody over there who does. Older than I am. And, I was wearing fancy clothes, and I was written up in the columns, and I was getting a lot of attention from the men, and I was table hopping every night, giving everybody a break, you understand. And, that was really, to the outside world, I should have been ecstatically happy. But it seems to me that I was always walking around wondering why I wasn't happy. I had all these things going for me. How come I'm not happy? And I thought, well, in those days, I thought, when Hollywood discovers me and takes me down there, then that's the answer to this unfulfilled thing that I have down here all the time. So came the day when, indeed, I was invited to go down and take a screen test, and I went down with the attitude that Betty Davis had better start saving her money. Because, you know, I was on my way, I was going to set the world on fire, but I forgot to tell you, I was born scared. You know, it was said here last night, scared, you know. I didn't even know I was scared until my sponsor told me after I got on AA. But, you know, I had that facade of false bravado. But I went down and took that screen test, and it was rotten. The reason for that being, how can you act when you're already acting? And I didn't even know that, see? So, anyway, they did sign me to a stock contract, which means, you know, you're part of the herd there. And like I said, I was used to a lot of attention. And I was, again, unhappy because, I wasn't immediately gaining that stardom that I felt that I certainly deserved. And, of course, I immediately got caught up with the drinking crowd. Every once in a while I hear new people say, "What am I going to say to my friends? They all drink." Well, of course they do. We don't hang around people that don't drink, for God's sake. Or do what we're doing, you know, take a little pill here and there. Tablets, they used to call it in my day. But anyway, I got caught up with the drinking crowd. And, you know, I made the fancy supper clubs and the nightclubs. And I was a playgirl. I returned to my role as a playgirl. And I didn't do a hell of a lot in pictures. You know, I did a few cameo roles and I did some dancing and this, that, and the other. But I just sensed that I wasn't going anywhere in this career, and I began to worry a little bit. And about the end of the second year I was on this lot, a man from the USO office came to me from Beverly Hills and offered me an opportunity to go overseas and entertain the soldiers because the World War was on. World War II was on at the time. And, you know, I just jumped at that chance because knowing that my career was not going anywhere there, first thing I thought of was all those men over there. You know how it is, ladies. And all the attention I was going to get. And that was a lifesaver to me. I just couldn't wait to get over there. And I went over there. I want to tell anybody here, any of you guys that still harbor a resentment about USO girls fraternizing only with the officers, I want to tell you, I was very democratic with my drinking. I drank with Yardbirds, Generals. It didn't make any difference to me. I never said what. I just said where and let's go. And on this trip, I got into a lot of trouble. Could you believe that? I got into a lot of trouble. On this trip, we went to Africa, China, Burma, and India. And it was the height of the war. And that's 40 years ago, and one of the big clues about alcoholism is defending your right to drink, right? I didn't know anything about alcoholism any more than you did, but we were over there in China, and we were in, you know, high up in the Himalaya Mountains, where this incident took place. I had been drinking grapefruit juice and something with the guys the night before. And I woke up I didn't even come to the following morning. I was paralyzed. And my roommate, the other gal on the show, noticed that there was something terribly wrong with me, so she went and got the medics, and they came trooping over, and they gave me oxygen and shots, and I don't know what all. They worked on me for 2 hours just to get me up on my feet and functioning again. And you know, I blamed the altitude. I had myself so sold on the altitude that I didn't even drink in Denver after that. I just knew I couldn't drink in altitudes. And that's what you call defending your right to drink. And, you know, it was terrible. I finally, you know, got up on my feet and did the same thing over and over again. And it never occurred to me, you know, that normal people don't do that. So anyway, I came back from that tour. I felt very put upon because I felt that the military had not told us that they expected us to entertain these soldiers between shows and drink with them and, you know, all that. And actually, they hadn't demanded that of us at all. I had demanded that of me because I was one of those people who absolutely would do anything to get your approval. My God, you know, I wore all these different masks and carried a suitcase full of others in case these didn't work out. You know, just to get your approval. I have found, since I have come to Alcoholics Anonymous, that in playing all those parts and doing all these things to get your approval, I was throwing away my own. And that's the one I needed the most. That's the one I need the most today. And so from there to here, you know, today I'm able to live in a manner that's acceptable to me regardless of public opinion. And that's, you know, that's a big jump. For me it is. Anyway, I was offered now an opportunity to go over to the European Theater. And this is where Chapter 3 comes in. This is where they wrote Chapter 3 about me. Because I said to myself, this time it's going to be different. Right? This time I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to get all involved in drinking and partying and doing all these things. This time I'm going to mind my P's and Q's and, you know, be a... So, anyway, this time it was different. It was worse. And the reason for that is I didn't know how not to get involved in all these other things. And I got into a lot of trouble over there. In fact, I'm probably the only USO girl that was up for court-martial. And the reason for that being, you know, I hit an officer. I have to tell you about this. I always tell this because I have this, I still have this fantasy, this dream. See, I was always madly in love. Either that or I was recovering from love, and I don't know which I enjoyed the most, you know. That bittersweet recovery, you know, that, you get the, you know, you get that sad music on, you know, you get the, you know, like, you get that music on that has no hope to it at all, you know, like the man who got away, or, you know, one of those, and get the jug out, you know, and start drinking and crying, and, oh, God, I used to love that. But anyway, I fell in love with this handsome lieutenant. And somewhere down the road, again, was involved in a drinking party, and I suddenly decided I need to get in touch with this fabulous, one great love of my life. And what they had there was field telephones because the war was just over. And so sometimes it took a little while to make connections with these field telephones. They had to go by relay. So I was sitting there waiting for this beloved to answer the phone, and this captain, who was also drinking, leaning over me, asked me to go drink or play or whatever, did a very bad thing. He took his thumb and disconnected my connection. And I said to him, Captain, if you do that once, we're going to hit you. And he did not believe me because he did it again. And I, since I had the phone in my hand, I whacked him on the ear as hard as I could. And, you know, he was so stunned or drunk or both that he didn't know what happened for a couple of minutes until the blood gushed out of his ear and down his white trench coat. And now I was in trouble, and I knew it. And he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hosteled, and he signed, you know, all these things, and they all came trooping over, and he pointed at me, and that's humiliating, you know that. And I was ordered to appear the next morning at 10 o'clock. So I spent the rest of the night trying to figure out, how am I going to get out of this one? Did you ever do that? How am I going to get out of this one? I figured that since there were 14 girls on this show, if I took two of the other brunettes with me to this hearing, there was just an outside chance that this guy was so drunk he would not be able to identify me. And that's what happened. We showed up at 10 o'clock, and that poor captain was sitting there with poached eyes and a hangover that was coming over in waves, you know. And he could not identify me. That isn't where you're supposed to applaud. That isn't where. What happened was, that, you know, in looking back, I am almost certain that he was one of us, And, of course, my big dream always has been that he found us. He found Alcoholics Anonymous. And that one day I'll be up on the podium talking about this incident, and he'll be in the audience. And it might even be this morning. Who knows? And after the meeting, he will come up to me with his hand extended, and he'd say, "Mary, I'm the captain that you hit on the ear. And I'm going to let him make his amends to me. Now you can apply." That's where you applaud. See, because we weren't always wrong. Even a clock that stopped is right twice a day, you know. So, you know, I can look back and laugh now, but it was about that time that I didn't know anything about alcoholism. But it seems to me, in looking back, that my alcoholism had already started to erode my spirit. You know, I was always kind of on a bummer. I was always depressed and trying to get that alcohol or some bennies that I was introduced to lift my spirits. And it just never quite did it. Just never. And I kept trying. And then I started to blame outside things. You know, you never blame the alcohol. You never blame that because you have to defend. That's the only thing. See, that wasn't my problem. That was my answer. So you can't blame that. You got to blame other things. You got to blame outside things, like man's inhumanity to man. And I had seen all the evidence of the Nuremberg trials that they were getting together, and I saw all the horrors of those things, and I blamed my depression and the whole thing on those things. Never the booze. The booze had not done anything for me for a long time. I didn't even realize it. All I knew was that once I got back to the United States and I got back to San Francisco and El Cerrito and Berkeley and all those places where I had so much fun. How much fun can you endure, for God's sake? I knew it'd be all right once I got back here. And so that's what happened. I came back, and everything here seemed to have changed. My best drinking buddies, they seemed to have changed. Everything was just different, And I just felt that, what am I going to do now kind of thing. But, you know, one of my philosophies was change conditions and things, and then everything would be all right. And so I decided, since I was 22 years old, what I should do is, you know, shape up, get married, settle down, and, you know, that kind of thing. And so I carefully selected a victim. happened to be a bartender I couldn't stand. And, you know, I know there's a lot of Al-Anons out there. They know that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it, right? This guy didn't drink, you know. And I always stayed away from people who didn't drink. He didn't drink, but I found a pot that fit because he was a compulsive gambler. And to give you a clue as to what kind of a marriage, well, it wasn't really a marriage. It was more like a suicide pact. But he gambled my drinking money, and I drank his gambling money. And the race was on. And we were both sick, you know. So I think shortly after that, I think we took the geographic for each other, because I knew if I got him away from all the gamblers and the bookies and everything up here, you know, I could straighten this guy out. And I'm quite sure that he felt that if he got me away from all the drinking buddies I had, then, you know, I'd be okay. So we moved down to suburbia, to Encino, California, out in the San Fernando Valley. And I found a drinking buddy right across the street, and he found some bookies right up on the corner, and the race was on again. Now, at this point in my life, I couldn't stand another failure, because I felt like a failure in every area of my life. So I decided that what I should do is get pregnant, have a baby. That would change everything. And so I did get pregnant, and now I've changed everything that I was going to be. I was going to be like those ladies in my neighborhood. You know, I was going to do everything by the numbers. I was going to do the laundry on Mondays and hang it out in the backyard and chit-chat over the fence and wear pink curlers to the market and do the lawn on Sundays and, you know, do that kind of thing because I didn't have any identity of my own. And I knew that this woman that I was now going to be, this perfect woman and perfect mother, I knew that she didn't drink. So I went on the wagon. God, that chokes me up when I even use that phrase. And, I got nuttier than the fruitcake. I became a compulsive housekeeper. There's always one or two out there, others, you know. I was cleaning the corners with pins. And I had Q-tips in my pockets that got the little edges. I know there are others. And I had a toothbrush that I cleaned the lettering on the appliances with, you know. And if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the John, his bed was made before he got back. And, I mean, that's a tense way to live, I'll tell you that. And, you know, you may feel that that's a little bit of alcoholic exaggeration, but it's not really. I was talking up here one time, and some Al-Anon came up to me after the meeting. She said, I did all of those things, but I did something you didn't do. And I said, what's that? She said, I used to blow the dust out of the keyholes. Well, you know, those people, you know, that's why I know I belong here, because now we're talking about things I used to hide from myself. I wouldn't dare tell anybody about these things that were going around in my head or those things that I was doing. But here these people talk openly about things we just hid all our lives. It's wonderful. It's that fabulous, fabulous freedom. So anyway, it just got from bad to worse. It's a wonder I didn't boil that kid when he was born. Because I was washing the walls with Hexol, you know. And it was madness, sheer madness. I knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what it was. And I was absolutely compelled to do these things. It was just nuts. But I didn't know what to do about that. So this went on for a while. And then I found that I was pregnant with my second child. And now I hadn't planned this one. Now, you know how that is. I always drank with two attitudes. One was, what's the use? And the other was, I'll show him. And here it was, what's the use? I've got this first kid's whole life mapped out. What kind of clothes he's going to wear, what he's going to be, what schools he's going to, what kind of friends I'm going to allow him to have, etc., etc., etc. And here comes this intruder. Screwed up my plans. And disappointment, disillusionment always got me drunk, and here it was again. So I went back to drinking socially with a lady across the street. And it wasn't very long before the progression just hit me, you know, so hard. And I was floundering around there. This is the period where I got a little more honest with myself and went back to my favorite haunts, the neighborhood bar. I love the bars. I tell you, I love the dark, unreal atmosphere. I love those guys telling me that I was sexy, desirable, smart, intelligent. I will tell you that I never drank with a common laborer in a bar. I drank with nuclear scientists and big politicians and those kind of people. And most of all, I loved the bullshit that was going on. I loved the bars. And so, pregnant and inhabiting a moo-moo, that's what my life had become. And so, after my second son was born, my husband took a dim view of my activities and he left me. And then he came back and left me again and came back. It was always the same thing. Came back for the sake of the children, which is, you know, hell of an excuse, for the sake of the children, but we believed it at the time, and he always promised he wouldn't gamble so much if I wouldn't drink so much, and again, the promises that we couldn't even keep to ourselves, never mind to each other, and again, it was, total disaster, and by that time, I realized I was pregnant the third time, and I was outraged womanhood, because it was all his fault, you know, and So by this time, my alcoholism had progressed, and this is a part of my life that I'm not particularly proud of, but I don't have to walk around being ashamed with my head downcast either. I was drinking most of the time. I was pregnant with my daughter, and it wasn't that I didn't care. It's that I couldn't care. I really couldn't. You know, my whole life was a failure. And I was even a failure as a wife, as a woman, and everything else. So what the hell's the use? You know, what's the use? And I couldn't come up with any reason why I should straighten out, nor did I know how to. And so I stumbled around that neighborhood and flopped around like a fish. And, you know, I was a neighborhood disgrace is what I was. And the neighbors weren't even talking. The women weren't even talking to me. I was drinking with their husbands, of course. And that's another reason that they weren't talking to me. But anyway, after my third child was born, my husband left me for what proved to be the last time, and now I could drink and I could live the way I wanted to live once he's off my back, and my drinking had progressed to the point where I was just almost drinking around the clock, and by that time I had such a homicidal hatred for him that it just fueled my alcoholism to the point where I was justified. I was justified. My mother and father finally turned their backs on me. They got tired of coming over and taking care of my children and cleaning my house while I was out, you know, roaming around. And they finally turned their backs on me, which is the best thing they ever did. And now all the things that happened to alcoholic women started happening to me. Those things that I swore would never happen to me, they happened to other people. But I remember coming to in an alley one cold gray dawn, sick and shaking and scared and wondering what had become of the great Belle of Bush Street. And I remember lurching down Ventura Boulevard one Sunday morning. I was so drunk I couldn't even stand up straight. And I remember, and I hope I never forget this. I hope I never forget it, because if my body was drunk and my head was sober. And that's a terrible place to be. That's a terrible place to be. Because I remember coming upon a Catholic church when Mass was just letting out, and this family coming down the steps with their two sons and these kids, the look in their eyes to see this drunken, reeling, dirty woman staggering and falling down. And you know, I didn't want to be there. I never planned to be there. I was choking on my own disgust and biting back my tears and cursing myself because I didn't want to be there. You know that. And there were other things that happened that I don't talk about from the podium, because I don't believe in taking a fifth step from the podium. Besides, none of your business. But you women know, you know, and I came from there. I came from there, and these things kept happening with such rapidity that I finally found myself drinking behind closed doors and drawn shades in my own home, drinking around the clock and knowing that I was going to kill this guy whose fault it was that I found myself in this position. I was absolutely, totally insane. In the meantime, I had called my doctor and told him, you know, about my insanity, and he sent me some of those tablets. And I was taking them in conjunction with my vodka, and it was just, that was a whole world of madness that I lived in, and I don't know how long it was. I don't know how long it was. All I know is that I was homicidal at the time, because I'd been also a failure at suicide. I had two suicide attempts and lost those. And so, I don't know, sometime I got that moment of clarity, I suppose you call it, a moment of clarity that told me that I definitely needed help. I needed help in the worst way. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it took me 2 years on AA to remember where I had heard about AA. And then I remembered that I was across the street at a drunken brawl 2 years before this call, and there was a red-haired woman there drinking a Coke. Now, I hated women, and especially those who weren't drinking. And I have no doubt went over to her and asked her why the hell she wasn't drinking. And it seems to me that she said something about finding a better way to live and something about AA. And see, this always reminds me that my responsibility is to scatter the seed and not demand that it sprout on the spot. Because this woman to this day, I'm sure, does not know that I'm sober. In fact, I don't even know if she is. But I've never seen her since that day. And so in calling North Hollywood Clubhouse, a young man answered the phone, and I was ranting and raving and totally insane, and he said he'd be right out. Now, he broke one of the unwritten laws of AA. The young men don't call on drunken ladies. But I didn't know that. But I'll tell you one thing, that if he came out with any romantic inclinations and he got to my front door, he was met with 180 pounds of screaming insanity, and especially if it was downwind, I'll tell you, that would have taken the romance out of him. Because I hadn't had a bath in a long time. It was too dangerous. I could have drowned, you know. But anyway, he came in with that big AA smile, and I was drinking out of my cheese glass. I was drinking my vodka out of my cheese glass and waiting for him to tell me that I couldn't drink anymore. Everybody else did. And I finally said, "Aren't you going to stop me from drinking?" He said, "No, go ahead." Well, God, that got my attention. And I kept drinking, and he was telling me about AA, and I asked him how much it costs and all this stuff, you know. He was the only person that I knew of that would talk to me. Everybody else was hanging up on me. So, anyway, he talked me into going to my first meeting that night, and I said, okay. So I put on my raincoat, and I don't know why I did that. It wasn't raining. Maybe to cover up. I don't know. That I had this... I poured one more drink, and I said, "Are you sure it's okay if I have this one last drink?" And he said, "Yeah, go ahead." And I said, "To hell with it." That's the last drink that I've had since that time to this. That was March the 29th, 1961. I didn't even know that was going to be it. But anyway, he got me out there. We went for miles and miles and miles out to... it was so desolate and dark and everything. I thought this guy was taking me out the country to kill me. And I was hoping he would. I really was. I just hoped he would. Then we got to this place where there was a little tiny building beside a church. There was a little tiny thing. And I looked in the window. This was the meeting. I looked in the window. There were about 15, 20 people in there. And I thought, oh, God, another PTA meeting. You know, I've been that route. And I started to back off. And I know that he sensed this. So he said, "Well, come around to the front door." And I went around to the front door, and he took his hand and shoved me in. You know? And, you know, I don't care what you say. That's promotion. That's not attraction. So he broke rule number two, you know. I didn't know any of those things, you know. He also told me I was alcoholic. You know, that's a no-no, isn't it? But Jesus, you know, when he told me I was alcoholic, it sounded so scientific to me. I was glad to accept it compared to what they had been calling me, God. You know. So anyway, I get to that meeting, and he introduced me to the woman who was to become my sponsor. And God, she represented everything I hated in women. She was soft-spoken, spiritual, well-groomed, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she spoon-fed my soul. That was the night, I don't remember what, I was so crazy and so drunk, and that was the night that the spark was ignited by a little old weazened guy. And I can still see his gnarly little hands when he came up to me after the meeting. And he put his hand, he put his arm around my shoulders and kissed me on the cheek. I hope I never forget that, because that's what ignited the spark. Because it had been so long since anybody had done that. Anybody had put their arm around me and validated me as a human being. And so my sponsor took me home that night, and we sat in the driveway for a while, and she looked at me dead in the eye and said, "Our relationship has to be based on strict honesty." God, it scared the hell out of me. I didn't even know I was a liar until then. And then she said something that struck terror into my heart. She said, "I will pick you up at 8 o'clock, and we're going to a woman's stag." Oh, my God. I was too afraid to tell her I hated women. And the next day I woke up and I had the worst hangover. I mean, one of those terrible, terrible things. And I still had a half a bottle of vodka there. And I wanted a drink in the worst way. I knew that just one drink would do it. But then one thing I did retain from the meeting the night before is we don't drink today. We don't drink today. And so I thought, well, I'll try it. I've been on the wagon 1,000 times and it didn't work. And I didn't think this would really work either. But, anyway, it took me all day to get ready for that woman stag, and my sponsor picked me up, and we went up to the woman stag in Van Nuys, and I got up there, and I knew damn well I didn't belong. I didn't belong with those fancy ladies up there. There was a woman that was leading the meeting that had she was a blonde, beautiful gal with every hair in place, and she had one of these expensive little black dresses with the pearls and everything. I got pearls on, notice? I thought, oh, my God, a toast burner, Jesus, you know. This one's never been off the block, for God's sake, you know. And I knew damn well I wouldn't fit in there because I felt so dirty inside. And so, you know, I felt used and discarded. And you know how you feel, gals. And I just felt I didn't fit in there. But then, you know, I think when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, because the next gal I got up and spoke, she spoke in my native tongue, profanity. Yeah. And, you know, I got a little spark there. So, and I talked to her for a long time after the meeting because my sponsor was very spiritual. And Gerda can tell you that. Anyway, I started to go to 10 meetings a week. Not so much that I could understand what the hell you were saying, but I was drinking up that feeling, that spiritual thing that floats around here, this power that's in this room right now. That's what I could not get enough of. I went and in half of me was saying, but at the next meeting you're not going to find it. But by God, every meeting I've been to since then, I have found that feeling. And that's what I just ate up. And in the meantime, there was a nucleus of four guys in this original home group of mine that were real hard-nosed guys. Real hard-nosed. And I bless them. I swear to God, if it hadn't been for them, I don't know whether I would have made it or not. And for my sponsor, they were all those old-time hard-nosed mossbacks that wouldn't let you get away with anything. And it was because of them that I'm standing up here today. I'm sure of that. My husband got the news that I was in AA, and in his own insanity, he started to threaten me, and he was calling me a certain time of the day and threatening to take my children and threatening to kill me. And I knew that he would do that because he was sick in his own way, and it drove me right up the wall. And one day I had to call my sponsor, and I said, my God, I don't think I can hang on anymore. I don't think that I'm going to last here. I think I'm going to kill this guy, you know, whether I'm drinking or not, because he's driving me crazy. I said, what am I going to do? And she said, hang up. It never occurred to me. I come from where you get even, you know. Hang up. I thought she was crazy. But I had, again, run out of my own resources, and the next time he called, I just went over, and with my guts were churning, I picked up the phone, and I said, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting my serenity, and I hung up real fast. And I kept doing that, and he finally stopped calling me, and things were going along fine, and I was going to all these meetings, and I was drinking it up, and I was loving it, he was not calling, and I really was fitting in with the women. I just loved those women, and God, I mean, they saved my sanity because they, you know, in talking with them, they knew me better than I knew me, and it was great. And one day, again, my husband, in his own insanity, called and again threatened me, and it was the night of the woman's stag, and I went screaming to the woman's stag. That homicide was up here, right, choking me, and I went screaming, and I said, what am I going to do? And this very elegant lady that I was describing earlier, you know what she said to me? She said, pray for the son of a bitch. Yeah, that's the last thing I wanted to do. Of course, everything's been the last thing I want to do, you know that. And so that night, I started, you know, saying the Lord's Prayer. I started to pray for him. I didn't mean a damn word of it. But I did it because they told me to. And that's why I'm here today, because I just did what they told me to do, even though I didn't believe it. Most of the time, I didn't believe it. But it did start working. And pretty soon, this terrible anger, this terrible feeling that I had started to lift from me. And in the meantime, I'm still going to 10 meetings a week. And in the meantime, I'm still loving AA and everybody in it. And then everything smoothed out again. As a matter of fact, one day my husband came and he wanted to be friends. And we sat down and talked about the future of the children and so forth and so on. And so it was going along like that when one of those hard-nosed guys from my home group came to me and he said, "Don't you think it's about time you made amends to this man?" And I said, "If you think so, I'll do it." I didn't feel like it, but anyway, because of him, I was privileged to make my amends to him just 2 weeks before he died of a heart attack. And that was the day, I suppose, that my never-ending love affair with the people of Alcoholics Anonymous really started, because even though I'd been sober 4.5 months, it seemed to me that literally hundreds of people came by wire, by phone, in person, every way you could come to my house and offer themselves, asking nothing in return. And I was overwhelmed and I was sustained. And so here I was, 4.5 months sober. I had 3 little kids, absolutely no money. In fact, very deeply in debt because of his gambling. And, of course, my drinking didn't help that. And here I was. But I can't recall that I was particularly afraid. And I guess it was because I had this tremendous support system around me, encouraging me. And it was... It was possible, to go along with what they were telling me to do. And at the time, we had been running a restaurant for about 13 years there, and now the AA people were coming into the restaurant, drinking up all my coffee. And they told me I had to, continue running this restaurant in order to pay all the debts off. And I thought that was rather unfair, but they told me that's what I had to do because I had to be responsible. And in the meantime, for the whole year there, we started having meetings at the little restaurant. And pretty soon, at the end of the year, I had all my debts paid, and the restaurant became a clubhouse. And the clubhouse is still in existence. And I can't take any credit for that because it just evolved. I told you how it evolved. We needed that kind of a nut house out there someplace. And anyway, it was shortly after that that I got involved in an AA marriage. I think everybody ought to try it just for the hell of it, you know. Just for the experience, you understand. And, I married one of those spiritual giants. He was a spiritual giant in the meetings. At home, he was not. Anyway, I guess he felt the same way about me. But anyway, it was just bad news. Well, anyway, I got through that, and I didn't have to drink. See, I keep telling you, you don't have to drink. And, I got a job in a hospital kitchen, the most menial job I ever had in my life. I was washing pots and pans and cleaning employees' toilets. Now, you got to remember, I was a big movie star. And here I was in this menial job. I was talking to Fran this morning. I said, "Hell, you know, your story and mine in sobriety is worse than some of these drunk stories, you know." I was working in this, and I hated the job. I just hated it. I couldn't imagine why I had to be working down there, $1.15 an hour. And I know it's why I was working. I was, putting some food on the table for my kids. And by that time, anyway, my original sponsor had moved up here to someplace, Angels Camp or someplace, and I chose Clancy as my sponsor. Now, Clancy says things that are very pertinent. As you know, he says some things that, just keep me glued together many times when he's not available. Like, some days you just hang on, and that's true. I like those kinds of directions because sometimes I get so screwed up, I can't hear anything else, and that's what sustains me, something like that. Anyway, I was at this job, and I couldn't imagine why God wanted me to stay there. And Clancy said, well, when God wants you to leave there, he'll move you. So came the day when he moved me. But in the meantime, I realized why I was put there. I was put there to have my values changed. See, all my values were rooted in money, property, and prestige. And as I told you, at one time, I had money, property, and prestige, and I always came up empty. But here, I learned different values. I learned the spiritual values that we are talking about in AA. And when I mean spiritual, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about things of the spirit. That is spiritual. Because, see, if I had not become acquainted with those kinds of values, I could not now tell you how it was for me when my oldest son got made first string varsity in high school, and I was invited out to his first game, and I couldn't describe to you this tremendous feeling of gratitude that grabbed me by the throat as I walked into that stadium, realizing that the people of AA had made it possible for me to walk into that stadium with my head up, made it possible for me to participate in one of the most important days of my kid's life. And so I went in there and I sat clear in the end zone because I wanted to feel this tremendous gratitude that was choking me. And I watched those kids warming out up on the field, and I, you know, when his name was called as a starting player, I broke down and cried. I couldn't have done that before had my values been different. Because it would have been meaningless. And besides that, I probably would not have shown up at all. And if I did, I would have been a disgrace. And I would have been an embarrassment. But because the people who cared about me, when I couldn't care about myself, pushed me in that direction, I was able to sit there and cry out of total sheer gratitude. And my second son followed in his footsteps. And I was out there every Friday crying. And, you know, it's just been fantastic because I was privileged to go to both of their formal weddings. I remember my second son when he got married, and by that time I was over in Honolulu, and I had come up for the wedding, and I was standing behind the double doors, you know, where you wait for the guy to come down and drag the old lady up the aisle. Anyway, I was standing there, and I remember I was standing there with this beautiful green satin dress on, and I was thinking to myself, my God, here I am, you know, I've got this beautiful dress on, I've had a bath, I've got underwear on, and all these things that are different than what they used to be. And just about that time, the double doors opened, and my oldest son grabbed my hand and put it under his arm, and he gave me a big squeeze, and I could tell by the look in his eye that it was a look of pride, you know, and that's something I never bargained for when I came here. I never bargained for that at all. I never bargained for the respect of my children at all. And so he took me down the aisle, and as I approached the front of the church, there on the right-hand side were these neighbor ladies that were not talking to me when I came to AA. And they hadn't seen me for several years because, as I said, I had been living in Honolulu for a couple of years. And they had this look of awe when I came down there. They couldn't believe what they saw. Because, see, I was flopping around that neighborhood like a fish in a dirty muumuu the last time they saw me. And, you know, I sat down, and the lady who used to live next door to me, with whose husband I used to drink with, patted me on the shoulder, and as I turned, she kissed me on the cheek. And that was a tremendous message. That was a tremendous message. And I want to tell you that boy that I was talking about, a couple of months ago, I was speaking up in Oxnard. And this kid is now, I got to brag a little bit, he was named Salesman of the Year for Massachusetts Mutual. And he has a beautiful home, and he has given me three beautiful grandsons. And he has a very spiritual wife, and I mean, he has the ideal everything, you know. And he drove me to the Oxnard meeting, and he heard me talk. And on the way home, he didn't say anything for a while when we got in the car. And suddenly he said, Mother, The next time you talk to those people, tell them if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be where I am today. I thought you'd like to know that. And my oldest son, you know, he has a beautiful wife, and he's given me a couple of grandchildren, too. And it's been great for the most part. But, you know, I could go on for many hours telling you about the wonderful things that have happened, the gifts that have been given to me. But I also have to be honest and talk to you about my pain. The pain has been tremendous. My daughter at the age of 12 picked up her first drink, and another alcoholic was born. And I was to know the sleepless nights and the visits to the police department and the juvenile halls and foster homes and not knowing where she was and if she was. And the heartbreak of that kind of thing when your kid's out there on the street. And this went on for several years, and this was going on while I was working at the hospital. And I don't know, God's timing is wonderful if you don't mind heart attacks, I think. Because just at the precise time she decided that she wanted to give up that kind of life and straighten out, was exactly the time when the bank on the corner wanted to buy my house and was willing to give me my price. And that enabled us to move to Honolulu. I thought, you know, get her away from all these people. And besides, I wanted to go over there where it was nice and serene and, you know, have these fantasy things you have. And so we went to Honolulu. And after a few months, she started in again and kept getting into trouble. In the meantime, I became the manager of a 12-step house for women over there at St. Francis Hospital. And thank God for that. Because I had to be working with other women in order not to go totally insane worrying about my daughter. And I finally joined Al-Anon. And I always give the Al-Anons a big break because, you know, we get some of our best members from there. And I will tell you that those Al-Anon women saved my sanity over there. It wasn't that the AA women weren't giving me support, but then I needed something from Al-Anon that I wasn't getting from AA. And came the day when they gave me the strength and they gave me the courage and they gave me what I needed to do the last thing I wanted to do in my life. And that was my daughter got into so much trouble over there, she came screaming and asking for another chance, and I said no, and I had to take her down to the Honolulu airport. And while she cried and screamed and begged for another chance, I had to shove her on the plane and tell her, get the hell out of my life. And I had to walk away as fast as I could. And the Al-Anon and the AA women were waiting for me to sustain me. And several months later, it came to pass that, did you ever notice it doesn't say it came to stay? It came to pass that my boss gave me a vacation, and I was just starving for some good, solid AA, which they didn't have in Honolulu at that time. And I came up to the San Fernando Valley to get my own cup filled, and I went to a Sunday meeting one Sunday night, and my daughter was reading Chapter 5 from the podium. And I would like to say that from that day to this, she's never had another drink or any more drugs. Unfortunately, I don't have that kind of report to make. And one of the reasons, you see, I believe that God compensates. And I think He sent me up here because I need you people. Because in the last 2 months, it has been necessary for me to go to court and take her 18-month-old baby away from her because in her sickness she has been dragging this poor little kid around to all the drug dens in the worst part of town. And she is so sick, she doesn't even realize she's doing these things. I've had to shut her out of my life. And in the last 2 weeks, I have had to put my little grandson up for adoption. And it's been the most painful period of my whole sobriety. And I would not have been able to make it had it not been for the people who care about me when I couldn't care about myself. There are people in this room, look around, like me, who are living examples that you can stay sober with a broken heart. Her life and the kid's life is none of my business. Because, you see, my life is none of my business. That's what step three tells me. And so for me, what I go on is being around you people. That's where I get my strength. And you know, I told one of my sons the other day, I get goddamn tired of being strong sometimes. I get tired of being spiritual. I just get damn tired. But see, this is the only place I can come and tell you people who understand that kind of thing. I'm supposed to be big, strong, and brave, and 23 years sober. You know, I'm supposed to be some kind of an example. Well, by God, I am. I'm not drinking. So you young people, anybody tells you that you're too young to be in this place, you tell them that you're not too young to die. Because I think that's what's going to happen to my kid. I don't know. I can't help her. And some of you kids have pounded more hell into 5 years than I did in 20, and I know that too. But you know what I go on? I know that every day, every night, all over the world, that there are over a million recovered alcoholics that are praying for people like her. And that gives me hope. But most of all, I want to tell you very sincerely that anything that I have of value, anything that I cherish, I got it right here from the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. But most of all, for teaching me to walk in the dignity of sobriety, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.